And so the question became, if the mediator is aware of something that counsel is not, can the mediator disclose that information? If so, how would they do it? Is that a proper thing to do?
Welcome to Mediation Matters, the podcast that explores the art and practice of resolving conflict.
Hello, my name is Ed Page. I'm a lawyer here at Carlton Fields, and I'm pleased to be here today with Charles Castagna. Charles, say hello.
Thank you, Ed. Great to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation with you.
So, we wanted to spend 5 or 10 minutes recapping the first installment of this podcast in a series called Mediation Matters, so that we could help the listeners be reminded of what we think are some important points to keep in mind. Charles, what about that first one having to do with preparation for the mediation, both as a mediator, perhaps, and as a participant?
I think the way I framed it last time was prepare, prepare, prepare. And that would be really a request to counsel to prepare themselves, to prepare their client, and to prepare the mediator. And really, my goal in presenting it that way is to get people realizing that this is a great opportunity and one not to be taken lightly or not taken full advantage of. And the way to do that is to know your case, know their case, have the right tone in terms of how you present your case in mediation. Not too strong, not too soft, just right, like the three little bears. Firmly, respectfully, say what needs to be said. So those are just some general thoughts in terms of lawyer preparation. In terms of preparing the client, let them know that you're not going to be coming in with an aggressive, guns blazing approach with take no prisoners and we've got the greatest case and we're going to overwhelm you in court. It's really let them know that that's not going to be helpful. That's not what the process is about, nor how it will effectively be utilized. Remember, the other side has to settle if there's going to be a settlement. And so let the client know that the role of the mediator is not to make a determination, not to be a judge, not to make any sort of decision in the process, but to, in a neutral and impartial way, help the parties hopefully get to that point. And finally, to prepare the mediator. Help me help you is the way I like to frame it. Let me know what the case is about, the general nature of the dispute. What do you want to accomplish? What are your goals? And really what's most helpful in terms of my preparation is to know if you're willing to discuss these with me and fairly effective at getting counsel to do this, but let me know not only your strengths and the other side's weaknesses, but your weaknesses and the other side's strengths, because that can help me much more effectively talk with you and your client in the private caucus sessions in terms of why a risk analysis is going to be helpful and will hopefully move us closer toward reaching an agreement. So those are just some brief general thoughts on the importance of preparation and why it's helpful, not only to the process, but to you and your client in terms of hopefully getting a productive outcome.
Thank you for that, Charles. My 2 cents on this issue that you've been talking about is as follows, and that is, I think for the litigants as well as for the mediator, it's important to understand what the purpose of the litigation is. And in that regard, I don't mean whether it's to prevail or establish a claim or a right or the like, but I mean as follows, and that is, litigation is not really designed to prove who is right. You can get a settlement. You can do other things in litigation, but most of the time I don't convince the defendant, if I'm the plaintiff, that I'm correct, that I'm right, that I'm entitled to win. And it's really the same for the defendant. Defending, I'm not going to convince, even though I may establish an affirmative defense or that I may resolve the matter in my favor, that I'm correct. What the parties have done is simply agreed to a settlement and to end a dispute with some kind of resolution. Knowing this and putting litigation in the proper perspective, you see, to me, is your goal at mediation. And that is, I'm not here to change the view of the other side's case. I can't do it in an hour or two or three or even an all-day mediation. All I can hope to do is to try to help the other side understand the risks in their case and that there is another view of the case and that the judge, if it's a bench trial or a jury, may entertain that view, that other view of the case. So if I go into the mediation with that understanding, with that black letter kind of point, it helps me understand what my real goals are, and that is I'm not going to change the other side's view. I'm just going to help them understand that there may be risks in trying to write or tell my story in a way in which I prevail. The other component that I think is important to mention here is that in mediations and trials and other dispute resolution platforms, so to speak, people really just want to be heard or helped, and sometimes hugged. But we don't do the hug part. We just try to provide a venue in which people can be heard. And so the focus, whether you're the mediator or the litigator or a party in mediation, is to be heard. That's really the essence of trying to reach a resolution. Trying to create an environment, a zone, a place where somebody can be fully heard, because without having been fully heard, your chances of resolving the matter that day go way, way down. We talked about this back on our first installment of Mediation Matters, and when I reviewed that, I realized that, well, I wanted to spend a little more time about what exactly listening is and allowing somebody else to be heard, not simply listening without interrupting, although that's an important part of it. But listening means not interrupting the other side, and when they're finished, asking meaningful and important questions. And those questions are along the following lines. Tell me again. Why? Help me understand. Explain that again, or explain that better for me. Tell me more. What do you mean? Say it again. And there was a psychiatrist who is now passed, but his name was Carl Rogers, and he practiced a particular approach that became popular and still for many professionals remains popular. And that is to simply repeat what the person told you in a nutshell, in an inflective kind of tone to draw out more and more information. And that often can be helpful at a mediation when you're listening, both from the mediator's standpoint and from a litigant's standpoint or the party's standpoint, to simply ask, say that again. So that's what real active listening means. It doesn't mean to interrupt. It doesn't mean to hijack the conversation. It means, as I like to call it, exhausting the other side until they're empty and they've been fully heard. It takes a little bit of time, but once you get to that point, you see, then the party is willing to discuss resolution. If you cut it off too short and try to get to resolution first, it's really self-defeating, particularly in the mediation process. It just doesn't work. Charles, I know that you're a big fan of trying to discern in mediations what a party can give up or concede and still try to get to a resolution. I call that the Abraham Lincoln factor because as I read some of Lincoln's strategies as a lawyer, he was all about trying to figure out what can I give up or concede, but still prove my case. So what do you say about that? I know you've done a number of mediations over the years, but how does this work into your practice as a mediator?
Well, I think, again, in terms of preparation, thinking about what factor issue you as counsel can concede and still reach a suitable agreement is part of your own preparation. What I've observed is that to some lawyers, this comes naturally. And I'm thinking of a very recent case where I observed, really almost uncharacteristically, a level of acknowledging a plaintiff's injuries, acknowledging what a good person she was and certainly presented as, and complimented the plaintiff, acknowledged that she would present well in court and make a very good impression, but also respectfully disagreed about how the accident happened, what injuries may have been pre-existing, et cetera, et cetera. But it was a very effective way of being disarming, but yet not at all really giving up their view of the case, but setting the table in such a way that it wasn't off-putting, which so many times I've seen this happen where someone just comes out very aggressively criticizing a party or criticizing their case or criticizing their lawyer. And it may be because that's what your client wants you to do. But again, stepping back and taking the larger view, that's going to be very ineffective and not at all helpful in the mediation process. So thinking that through and being able to acknowledge legal points, that, you know, you've got some good points here, but we've got some other points that we think a jury is going to consider or a judge will weigh heavily in terms of, you know, the judge's analysis of what to do here. So, but giving that some thought in advance, I think will set the table much more effectively to have a meaningful conversation and at the same time, getting the other party and perhaps their counsel to maybe pay more attention to what you're saying instead of immediately shutting you out because you're coming across too aggressively or in a manner that's just not inviting a helpful response.
Okay, thank you for that, Charles. So we also discussed in our first podcast session of Mediation Matters, preparing for mediation. And I know you've already stressed today, prepare, prepare, prepare. The mediator prepares, the party prepares, the litigant prepares. But I wanted to chat with you a little bit about some of the information and discussion we had about mediation statements, and in particular, addressing good facts and your bad facts in the mediation statement, and what your approach is to that, to encouraging that both in mediation statements and during mediation. What do you have to say about that?
Well, again, from the frame of help me help you, I find that as far as bad facts from either party's point of view or that of their counsel are much better considered and discussed in advance of the mediation. And I can think of a case in which I had reached out to counsel and said, help me help you. What, you know, what would be good for me to know? What, how can I make the process as productive as possible? And it was explained to me that I've got a very hard-headed client. You know, they're not seeing things clearly. They're not really listening to me that much. And again, this is never going to be put in writing, of course, nor should it be. But after having this conversation, it was agreed that counsel and I would have a discussion in the client's presence in a private caucus, so the other side is not hearing what's being discussed, talking about those weaknesses and the strengths of the other parties. And I think there was a case or two the client had mentioned that would be adverse to his client's interest. And so we talked about all of those things, again, not with me presenting myself as a judge or a decider or even one that originated these points, but just simply bringing up things that would be helpful to consider in terms of evaluating what might happen in court. And it just really laid the groundwork for a much more helpful and productive discussion. And I think really enabled the lawyer to, you know, enlist me in that effort to try to get their client more open-minded and willing to consider a more productive outcome for them.
Okay, great. Now, in your comments just now, I heard you mention that you reached out to the party in a mediation to be conducted to find out a little bit more. And tell us about that practice that you employ in your mediation matters.
Well, reaching out, it wouldn't actually be to the party. It would be to counsel if they are represented. And so just to make that point, but I can remember one instance in which I was reaching out to counsel for that very reason, because I had received nothing about the case, and it was a Friday afternoon, and the mediation was Monday morning, and I just simply asked, is there anything that would be helpful for me to know? And the response was, well, I don't know, not really, but I don't know, what are you thinking? And I wasn't trying to be a smart aleck about it, but I said, well, I don't know. I mean, for instance, if, and this is back in the olden days when we used to do in-person mediations, I said, if your client and the other client get to the office first, and that there's going to be a fist fight in the lobby. And I was just kind of making something up. And he says, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because that's probably exactly what's going to happen. So make sure you get there a half an hour early, and whoever gets there first, put them in one room. And, you know, if they get there before counsel, and that way you can keep them separate and make sure that we can not have an unfortunate incident before the mediation even gets started. Now, you would have thunk that information would have been forthcoming, but at least I learned that in advance, did get there early enough to make sure that wasn't a problem. But again, that's the kind of thing that A, is never going to be put in writing, and B, without that phone call, we would have all maybe been in for a very rude awakening as that the mediation was convened.
Help us understand, Charles. You mentioned in your comments just now that this was a situation where you were not provided a mediation statement. I'd like to hear what you think about that so that parties, the lawyers and mediators, can understand if you believe that this is a disability for the mediator undertaking a mediation when there's no mediation statement provided.
Well, I think, again, depending on the nature of the dispute, the type of case and whatnot, you know, a lot of mediators feel, well, I've been doing this for a long time, I can handle pretty much anything. And I mean, that may very well be true, but I think it's always helpful. And just to give an example, I'll begin with, if this is true, that either thanking counsel for providing summary information or for taking the time to talk with me, because it's always helpful for the mediator to know a little bit about what's going on. I understand this is a class action lawsuit or a personal injury matter, an employment dispute, whatever it might be, just to give a little bit, again, and I'll concede that I know by far the least of anyone in this room or anyone involved in this case about what's going on, but I've got a good idea of what we're here to try to do today, and that's what I'm here to help you do. So, you know, again, I think it's helpful in that way to A, acknowledge counsel, to let the parties know that their lawyer took the time and I listened to whatever they had to say or read whatever they provided for me to read so that I can, you know, again, hopefully conduct the process more efficiently and effectively than if I'm hearing for the first time that this is the wrongful death of a minor child or some other, you know, very, very serious type of a case where you're going to walk in. Everything is different in that type of a case. You know, you're not going to walk in a very lighthanded manner, or if it's on Zoom, you know, greet everyone with a jovial or humorous introduction when that's what is at issue and what's being discussed. It's a much more solemn presentation from the mediator as well as from the parties. But again, this is, you know, important to know for these very reasons.
So let me sum up if I have it right. Help me help you is one of your headlines. And that can mean, I prefer a mediation statement, but a mediation statement can consist of a formal mediation statement with topics and law and facts and the like, or it can consist of a conversation you have with a lawyer, or it can consist of a conversation that you have with a pro se, self-represented person, or it can consist of a text, an email, or some other form of communication where you're enlightened about the facts involved. Is that fair?
In this day and age, all of the above.
Okay. So we want to transition now to our next topic in session two of Mediation Matters, since we've finished the recap that we wanted to help the audience hear and understand. And that is, as part of the prepare, prepare, prepare part, we wanted to talk a little bit about the mediation statement and, in particular, materials that the lawyer might bring to mediation and might start gathering in order to optimize the time together during mediation. And I call that the mediation notebook, which might consist of a complaint the answer and affirmative defenses, a chronology of the facts, a list of the bad facts and good facts in the case, a succinct statement of the theme of the case. For example, this is, let's say, in a broken promise case, as I like to call it, in other words, breach of contract, that this is a case about broken promises, and maybe a statement of the theory of your case. The theory of the case would mean a statement that addresses all the good and bad facts in a case, but it explains to the mediator and to others what happened in the case and why. A pertinent jury instructions in case there is a legal issue that arises. Perhaps you've, by that time at mediation, prepared a trial brief. Maybe it includes the judge's preferences for the judge that's assigned to the case. It could include other information and the like, perhaps helpful quotes, like it's important to try to either decide whether you want to tell your story to a jury or a judge, or whether you want to write the end of your story and try to resolve the case for that day. But given that, Charles, what kind of things do you think are helpful to bring to the mediation, whether they are in the form of a mediation notebook and organized with an index and topical and the like? Someone, for example, who might follow the book, The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right by Atul Gawande, or someone who prefers a more informal approach and just brings in a red well the complaint and all the other things I just mentioned to the mediation. How do you see these things coming up in real-world experience as a professional mediator?
Honestly, I see everything from the very formal to the very informal to sometimes nothing at all. And again, that's what typically will prompt the phone call. And I do make that call even if I did receive background information. But again, I think it's my process would be more on the informal side. I might ask for, it would be helpful for me to know about the nature of the dispute. Pleadings may serve that purpose, or your own description of the nature of the dispute. What settlement discussions, if any, have been had, you know, again, trying to flesh out strengths and weaknesses as best I can. Again, that would be more discussed in a phone call rather than in writing, but just getting an idea of how did we get here, and hopefully a little bit of a hint about where do we go from here, because that's really the focus of mediation. And that's one of the comments that I make toward the end of my opening remarks during the mediation process. Is it's helpful. Thank you, counsel, for the information provided. So I've had this good idea of why we're here, but now the focus needs to shift into where do we go from here and how do we get there as productively and effectively and efficiently as we can.
So in the laundry list of items that I mentioned a few minutes ago, starting with complaint and ending with a mediation statement and maybe the judge's preferences that might become relevant during a mediation, I want to ask you a follow-up there, and that is, there is a mediation rule, I believe it's 10.370, that deals with a mediator speaking during a mediation about opinions and advice and the like. And I wanted to get your impression about that rule and tell our listeners what that rule speaks to.
10.370 of the Mediator Standards of Conduct. And when we conclude, I'll give a site for where that's available and can be looked up and read in its entirety. But it's the Advice, Opinions, or Information Rule. It talks about what information the mediator can provide, independent legal advice, which basically deals with when a mediator believes a party doesn't understand or appreciate how an agreement may adversely affect legal rights or obligations, the mediator must advise the party of the right to seek independent legal counsel. And I always, at least in mediation trainings that I used to conduct, I would caution in a jovial fashion that it was never my practice, and I would think never a good idea to do that if the party already had a lawyer, and to make that observation in the lawyer's presence that maybe your client needs a lawyer. But that is one of the things that a mediator, if there is someone who's unrepresented, that would really be what that's addressing, not someone who has counsel. And then finally, the personal or professional opinion section, the mediator is prohibited from offering a personal or professional opinion intended to coerce or unduly influence. However, the mediator may point out possible outcomes of the case, discuss the merits of a claim or defense, strengths and weaknesses, and the like. And finally, the last prohibition is that a mediator must not offer a personal or professional opinion as to how the court in which the case has been filed will resolve the dispute. So that's a very quick synopsis of 10.370. It's one of the more, I think, important rules. They're all important, but that's certainly one that delves into things that happen almost in every mediation, things that are important to keep in mind about how you conduct yourself and the process.
Would you call that one of the top 10 rules? That's
That would definitely be in the top, probably the top five.
Okay. So now I want you to tell us about what the acronym MEAC means, at least in Florida.
MEAC stands for Mediator Ethics Advisory Committee. It's a group of mediators that essentially render written opinions, not rules, not laws, not statutes, not directives, but opinions as to what that particular group, and I believe there are nine that serve on the committee, three from the northern, the middle, and the southern divisions in the state. And they get a question in writing, they deliberate, and they say, here's our opinion and here's our answer to the question. And it provides guidance. And again, I'll give a site at the appropriate time here today if people want to look up specific opinions. There's an index of by year and an index by topic, I believe, is how it's set up on the Supreme Court website. And it's they're very helpful. And again, you get the benefit of the thinking of a panel of mediators that's their job when the committee is convened is to answer these questions and give guidance to mediators about how to conduct themselves in the process.
Well, are you aware of any MEAC opinions that have discussed or interpreted the rule you just mentioned or that we're chatting about, the advice, opinions, and information rule, Rule 10.370?
There are two that I found, actually. The first is Opinion 2018-002, and that was a situation where prior to an appellate mediation, the mediator conducted some independent research and found cases that apparently neither lawyer in the case had found. And so the question became, if the mediator is aware of something that counsel is not, can the mediator disclose that information? If so, how would they do it? Is that a And essentially, the opinion of the MEAC in that situation was that providing case law to one or both parties would violate the standards of impartiality, as doing so may assist one party to the detriment of the other. Furthermore, providing case law would cross the line between being a mediator and being an advocate. It is improper for a mediator to provide legal advice by any method within the scope of a mediation, whether such advice is by statement, question, or any other form of communication, or by providing case law. So that's how that was addressed in that 2018 opinion. And then there was
Can I sum up there, Charles? My takeaway is if the mediator is offering case law, he's taking off his mediator hat and putting on his lawyer hat. Is that the sin that's involved in that MEAC opinion?
I couldn't have summed it up any better myself, Ed. You nailed it.
Okay, thank you. So let's go to that other MEAC opinion that you mentioned that also interpreted Rule 10.370, the advice, opinions, and information rule in Florida.
In this case, 2021-010 was the case. In that 2021 case, there was an inquiry about whether or not it would be proper for a mediator. And so this, I think, was actually before the mediation took place. No, I'm sorry, it wasn't before. The question, I think, was a hypothetical. In other words, it wasn't actually actively in a mediation. But the question was, would it be unethical, in other words, coercive for a mediator to make any reference? And this specific inquiry was regarding Chapter 720 requirements to participate in the entire mediation process. And there the MEAC opined that, first of all, a mediator should always take special care to preserve each party's right to self-determination And that's a theme that goes throughout the MEAC opinions. And their Rule 7, 10.370 was cited directly. And then also opining that it's not unethical for a mediator to address or reference the applicable statutes. Thus, a mediator may discuss issues with the parties or refer to applicable statutes, such as Chapter 720, for their consideration in accordance with the role of the mediator, as long as any advice or information offered by the mediator is consistent with the rules, preserves the party's self-determination, and maintains impartiality. So again, kind of paraphrasing the language of 10.370, they bring it in that way as well. So again, just always be mindful of what you're doing, what you're discussing, and how you're doing it. But certainly with regard to referencing Chapter 720, in this instance, that would be appropriate to reference in.
Okay. I want to talk about some quotes that you and I have used during today's podcast. And we'll start with meet them where they are, number one. Number two, help me to help you. And the third is brand new, and that is say what you mean what you say, and despite the stressful nature sometimes of many mediations, just don't say it mean. Let's start with the first one, and I'll ask you to help the listeners understand what you mean when you say, meet them where they are.
You know, Ed, I think it's really a matter of reading the room as you're convening the mediation. Some people are very uncomfortable in an informal setting. They like Dr., Mr., Ms., you know, just kind of talking in that way, you know, in terms of how you address them and how the matter is conducted. Others are much more comfortable informally on a first name basis. And you pick that up kind of as things begin. And more often than not, I'd say the informal is the more comfortable way and people are fine with it. And again, whether it's in person or on Zoom, you can sort of set that tone if it's appropriate by, you know, picking up on the fact that people are referring to each other or counsel on a first name basis and going along with that. Or if it seems like more formal is the way to go, more reserved, if you adopt that, I think you're going to be heard much more effectively and more clearly in terms of, you know, how the process is moving forward and how you're perceived in conducting it.
What else are you looking for in trying to meet them where they are?
You know, I think, again, if it's the kind of case where there's high emotional component to it, whether it be a wrongful death or a serious injury or whatever it may be an employment dispute, but there's just a very high emotional component to it, because that's what the parties bring. You know, I just think the solemnity that goes along with that in terms of responding to them, in terms of conversing, hearing how they're feeling about the dispute, about the other party, and acknowledging that, honoring that. And again, this is really going on at this point in the private sessions. And so it's really, I think, a matter of the rapport that you're building and maintaining with the parties. And that is to just, I think, again, be respectful of whatever it is that they are confronting and that you are now confronting, but as a participant in this mediation, to their efforts to try and resolve it, and being the best shoulder, ear, whatever you can do to support them by listening, by letting them vent if they need to vent for however long it is. I've had counsel, oddly enough, interrupt their client and say, well, that's really not relevant. We don't want to get into that. And you can see it's very relevant to the party. So again, without getting between the lawyer and the client, because you don't want to do that, you want to do to the best of your ability, right by the client and say, we've got the time. It's okay if they want to talk about that. If you don't mind counsel, it certainly is fine with me, and let them vent and air their grievances and criticize the other party, cry, curse, do whatever they need to do. But that's part of what you're there for, I think, in terms of and it's certainly a non-legal role, but I think it's a very important role to allow the process to unfold as it may need to.
I want to sum up, and that was people want to be heard, hugged, or helped. And we go back to this exercise of listening, not cutting off, asking for more information, and exhausting and allowing the person to empty themselves within reason before we transition to resolution. People want to rush this step of the process, but I've seen it as a mediator that whenever this part of the process is rushed, particularly in emotional cases that you've described, it leads to a longer mediation and sometimes a failed mediation. So let's kind of wrap up today with a couple of other statements that we'll talk about in mediation matters in the third session, and that is help me help you, and reading the room, and hearing people, and then finally say what you mean what you say, just to say it mean, as well as the following, and that is in our next session, we will address some of these quotes that we've just discussed and set forth and help people understand what they mean in the mediation context. But we're also going to talk about some other interesting features of mediation, and that is what is involved when the party to the lawsuit shows up without a lawyer. Lawyers call this the pro se party. We're going to talk about that. And number two, we're going to talk about a feature of every single mediation that I've been a part of and that I know exists, and that is the emotional component of the mediation and the case and the facts. It relates really to active listening. And then finally, I think we're going to spend some time on the format for most mediations now, which are Zoom mediations. And we'll call it the ABCs of Zoom mediations and what you need to know to capitalize on this format so that you can increase your chances of a successful resolution. So with that, Charles, anything to conclude with? You said you were going to give us some details about where I could find a MEAC opinion and where I could find the rule that you cited, 10370.
If you go to www.flcourts.gov, under the services link, there is an ADR link. And when you click on that, there is just MEAC opinions and the standards of conduct and the rules of civil procedure. All of the various resources are available on the court website there. Just a wealth of information and knowledge about the process and all of the nuances that we've touched on here this afternoon.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening today. We appreciate your time, and we will be back with you in our third installment of Mediation Matters at another time.
This podcast is intended for general information and educational purposes only and should not be relied on as if it were advice about a particular fact situation. The distribution of this podcast is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship with Carlton Fields.